Chapter 2. Over the course of the following week, Segundus accomplished a great deal. He reshelved all of the books that Childermas had made use of, it being Childermas's habit to remove a great many books from the shelves and leave them stacked across the floor in mysterious configurations that possibly functioned as defensive stockades. Then he reshelved all of the books again, after Childermas complained that he had not yet been finished, and removed them into even more convoluted stacks. He convinced a patch of hairgrass that it did not wish to grow in the Staircross garden, and spent a very long time explaining to the rosemary bush that it could not grow any further, for it risked putting its neighbor in shade. The rosemary had a prickly temperament, which made this a delicate matter, and was rather arrogant as well, but in the end Segundus appealed to its sense of mercy. "You are such a very grand plant," he told it, folding his arms around his knees and leaning earnestly close. "You must consider those who do not stand so high. The creeping thyme lives close to the ground, and it cannot contest you. It is quite dependent upon you to be kind to it." The rosemary rustled imperiously, but it liked being so flattered, and conceded that it would grow no further this summer, though it reserved the right to do so next year. Childermas, who was leaning against the garden gate and smoking his pipe, said, "You'll spoil them if you keep that up, catering to their egos in such a fashion." "It certainly does not astonish me that you would say so," said Segundus, looking up from the rosemary. "However, I am astonished that you are so replete with gardening advice when you never seem to do any gardening." Childermas shrugged. "What were you planning for dinner?" he asked. "Your visit seems to be stretching on for a very long time," Segundus said. But he grudgingly got to his feet and went into the kitchen, where he had half of a very nice venison pie and some wild cloudberries which would go nicely in a tea cake. As he was baking the tea cake, Childermas stole half the cloudberries, in spite of being whacked sharply several times on the hand. "You are incorrigible," Segundus said. "You are like a child. You are worse than a child." Childermas appeared not very much bothered by this. "Children are clever," he said. "They take what they want." "But they do not get what they might have had, which is cloudberry tea cake," Segundus said. "I am going to give you the slice that has the fewest berries in it."
"Why do you not cater to my ego?" said Childermas, disgruntled.
"Because you are not a plant," Segundus said. Childermas offered that he might become a plant if it meant that Segundus would stop nagging and stop reshelving books before he, Childermas, was done with them. It was surprisingly one of the nicest conversations that Segundus had ever enjoyed with Childermas, though this was not saying much, and he suspected that he was greatly influenced by his general satisfaction after the dream about Miss Absalom. Shortly thereafter, a boy from the village came to say that there was a drunken magician in the pub, and could Mr. Segundus come and remove him, please, before he frightened any more cows. Segundus and Childermas both immediately assumed the man in question to be Vinculus, who was more or less a magician and almost always drunk, but it rapidly transpired that Vinculus was asleep in the Staircross garden, entangled in an extraordinary number of vines and brambles. The drunken magician in the pub, on the other hand, was demanding cider and issuing challenges to the livestock of the village, inviting them to participate in magical combat. When Childermas and Segundus arrived, the magician also issued a challenge to Childermas, opining that he was unfit to be the reader of the king's book, and also that, in general, the process was undemocratic.
"Why shouldn't I," slurred the man, "have a look at the king's letters? I've as much claim as any man."
It was unclear what role the livestock played in this particular resentment. Nevertheless, he had behaved very badly towards them, alarming several sheep and a herd of cattle with his shouting, and his slurs against Childermas could not be allowed to stand. "Shall you call him out?" Segundus asked Childermas, gazing at the man very dubiously. Childermas gave him a sarcastic look. "I am not a gentleman."
"Shall I call him out for you, to defend your honor?"
"Nor am I a maiden," Childermas said, "though I am very intrigued by the idea of you calling anyone out. What would you duel him with? A crocus? A tea cozy?" Segundus felt a little stung by this.
"I do not see anyone else leaping to defend your honor," he pointed out stiffly. "Perhaps you would do well not to scorn the offers you get."
Indeed, the villagers of Staircross seemed quite content to leave the magicians to it, having ascertained that no magical combat with livestock was likely to occur. They had dispersed, leaving the road outside the pub empty, but for the drunken magician, Childermas, and Segundus. The drunken magician was finding it difficult to stand upright.
"You have cursed me, sir,"
he said to Childermas. How dare you? I insist you remove the curse at once. Childermas cast his eyes skyward and sighed. Run along home, he said to Segundus. I shall see the gentleman safely to an inn. Segundus said, indignant, I see no reason why I ought to run along home. This is my village, sir, and it was not your aid that was requested. I am aware that you think very little of me. However, the people of Staircross have a higher opinion. I will not simply fob off their concerns. At this point, the drunken magician vomited onto the cobbles. This caused a variety of untidy weeds to sprout from between the cobblestones and give off an alcoholic odor. It was rather an interesting display of magic, Segundus thought, though he doubted it would be appreciated as such by whoever had to clean the street. Childermas pinched the bridge of his nose. One quarrelsome magician I can handle. Two risk testing my patience. Run along and we may discuss the matter in the morning. This did not significantly improve Segundus's temper. He had called Childermas a child, but now Childermas was treating him like a child. A badly behaved child who was beneath his attention. Segundus disliked being condescended to in such a fashion. It was the sort of treatment that most rankled him, for he had been subjected to it most of his life. He had no intention of letting Childermas get away with it. Very well, he said. Very well. I shall run along, as you put it. But since I am of so little use to you, and you so scorn my presence, I trust that you will not be lingering at my home. It would be very inconsistent for you to do so. He searched Childermas's face for a reaction to this, but Childermas was, as usual, quite unreadable. So Segundus turned and marched towards Staircross, feeling very dissatisfied. He is intolerable, he told Miss Absalom later. He acts as though I am the most ignorant of fellows. He constantly mocks my work in the garden. He continually belittles me merely because I cannot make the rose bushes bloom or the brambles behave as I will. And yet at the same time, he abuses my library and takes liberties with my food. Miss Absalom looked extremely amused by this tirade. Men are peculiar creatures, she said. I dare say you yourself are quite as difficult when you set your mind to be. As for the rose bushes, it is the simplest thing. They have no confidence. You must flatter them sweetly before they will flower. They are so very diffident, you see. Oh, Segundus said, surprised. I had not thought of that. Then he realized for the first time that he was in Miss Absalom's kitchen, sitting in the late sunlight, drinking a golden kind of wine that tasted like laziness and lovemaking and heavy wildflowers and sleepy groves that hummed with bees. He set his glass down carefully. Forgive me, he said. This was not at all how I meant to greet you. Miss Absalom tilted her head and said teasingly, How did you mean to greet me? Segundus answered by leaning across the table and kissing her passionately. She tasted a little of the wine they were drinking, which is to say, very sweet. He moved his tongue in her mouth in a slow, concentrated fashion. When at last, out of breath, he pulled a little away, he said, I feel I could kiss you forever and never grow tired of it. I wish to kiss every part of your body. It is all I have thought of. She gave a gasping little laugh and took hold of his neckcloth to pull him towards her into her lap. How bold you have turned, she said. I find it very exciting. I should like you to kiss every part of me. You have a clever mouth and a clever tongue. Let us put them to work. Segundus was already kissing ravenously at her throat, his hand sliding down her body to caress her and trace the outline of her breasts. It was true what he had said. He had thought of her a great deal. He was not normally a man much given to sexual excitement, but the concrete memory of her soft, willing body, the pleasure that she had taken from him, her warm laugh and the heat of her clenched around him, had proved irresistible. I touched myself, he said breathlessly, against the constellation of freckles. Thinking of you, I could not help myself. Oh, Miss Absalom said, taking hold of one of his hands and slipping it inside her bodice, so he could touch the bare skin of her breast. Yes, I like that very much. Tell me what you imagined. Being inside me? Yes, Segundus said. Yes, and pleasing you, feeling you all around me. He blushed ferociously at having said this, and to hide it, lowered his mouth to her nipple. By licking very delicately at it, he could make her squirm, and he devoted a great deal of attention to achieving this effect until she had put a hand in his hair and pulled him back. Every part of me, she said. Will you? I am wet for you. I want you on your knees. As much as this rendered Segundus even further red, for he had never known a woman to say such things, it also stole his ability of speech.
He gaped at her for a moment, and then fumbled in his haste to slide to the floor, hiking up the cloth of her dress and pressing his mouth to the inside of her thigh. He wanted to touch every inch of her skin, which was so bare and so fragrant and so enticing. He kissed her thigh in a long, confused, shaky line, spreading her legs wide as he did so. She leaned back in her chair, tilting her hips up. She had told the truth. She was very wet. Secundus parted the lips of her and gazed at her in fascination before lowering his head to tentatively lick. The taste and texture of her were strange and exciting. When he probed at her with the tip of his tongue, he could feel her tense, and her hand came down to clutch at his hair. This was even more exciting, and he pushed his tongue in, lapping at her folds, at the stiff little organ that made her jerk and gasp and beg. He could not resist pushing a finger in her and feeling the deep well of her, so wet, where he would push his prick, where he could fill her with himself. The thought made him moan against her, which she seemed to enjoy. He looked at her more fervently, learning the map of her pleasure so he could leverage it against her, employing that knowledge, merciless, to drive her quite wild and nonsensical, till she was crying out and tightening and dragging his head against her, holding him there firmly, saying, "Yes, yes, yes," and then her climax. He leant back, wiping his mouth, breathless. He stared at her. She had chucked her dress over her head and was dappled red as though with sunburn, sweat-curling tendrils of hair to her neck, and he had never desired someone more. He wanted to do it to her all over again, to make her make those sounds, to feel her hands clutch at his head, and to feel the quiver of her most sensitive flesh, where it was subject to his tongue, leaving her quite helpless. He rested his hot face against her thigh and touched her lightly as she recovered, slipping two of his fingertips just inside her, just enough to feel her wetness. She made little noises at this, but they were noises of delight, so he pushed the whole fingers in, and she took them eagerly, riding lightly against them. He had to push a hand against his prick at this, for it was painfully hard, and her eagerness made it jump. "I want to," he said dazedly. "Can I, again, I want to give you your pleasure." "Oh," she said in a low, dark voice. "Yes, yes. Only, I do not know if I am able." "You are," Secundus said, rather boldly, and he thrust his fingers sharply in before bending his head and giving her the full intensity of his tongue, the broad flat of it in heavy licks, and the sharp edge in delicate patterns. He was aware of her crying out almost ceaselessly above him. For a time he had mercy and immersed himself in licking his way inside her, beside his fingers, as though he were fucking her slowly with his tongue, emerging occasionally to tease her into noisiness once more. At last she grew very desperate and began begging him for it, tugging at fistfuls of his hair. So he gave himself over to evoking her pleasure. He felt he was dragging it out from under her skin, pulling all her nerves into a point of high tension. He scraped his teeth against her and felt her thrash, and then he was giving her the hard, fast tonguing that sped her towards her climax. She seemed to hover at the edge of it for a very long time. Her body bowed, straining, quivering all against him, and then he could feel the instant of it under his hands. It was extraordinary, watching her give herself to it. He had never given another person so much pleasure. "You are astounding," he told her, kissing her thighs, her belly, lifting his head to kiss her breasts. "Astounding, wonderful, please let me, please." He was half lifting her out of the chair, and she half stumbled into his arms with a great deal of laughter. And then she was unbuttoning his breeches hastily, pulling him out, and lying back upon the floorboards, so he could enter her and fuck her frantically. She was so wet and so hot, and welcomed him into her. After a moment, she lifted her legs up to his shoulders, which changed the angle of his thrusting in a way that was intensely delightful. He was shuddering already, so overcome by the intensity of being inside her. At one point, she clenched very hard around him and let him push his way against her, and he had to close his eyes shut and cry out. She seemed to enjoy this effect. "Beautiful," she murmured. "Yes, take your pleasure. Give yourself to it." She put a hand against his overheated cheek, which was cool and welcome. "Oh God," he choked out, desperate, and thrust wildly forwards, and climaxed very violently. It took all of the strength out of him. He could do nothing afterwards except lie limply upon her, breathing wetly, feeling as though someone had wrung him out like a cloth. Miss Absalom stroked his back. She remarked, "It astonishes me that you have no other lover. I think you are the most delightful lover I've ever had. You have so much zeal for the act. It is very charming." "Secundus said. He felt very warm and contented and was happy to be petted, but he was not quite up to conversation yet. She laughed at him and pushed his hair back from his face. Truly, and I have had my share of lovers. Are you as talented at magic as you are at pleasure? Segundus groaned. He hid his head at her shoulder. I'm quite hopeless. I fear you would abandon me entirely if you saw me perform magic. I doubt that very much. I am the humblest of scholars. I fear I am artless. But you have love, Miss Absalom said. With love, a great many things are possible, you know. You may find your artfulness yet. And she kissed him very tenderly, and began to tell him a long story that she claimed had been told to her by the ghost of Ralph Stokesy. It involved a young girl who wished to ask the Raven King a favor, and who undertook a great many trials to win this right. Segundus kept interrupting her to ask questions, but Miss Absalom never seemed to mind. Indeed, she had the scholar's delight at digressions. The unfortunate consequence of this, however, was that by the time she came to the end of the story, Segundus was so very sleepy that he could not keep it straight in his head. He did not think that she had reached the conclusion by the time he drifted away into weightlessness. The next morning he awoke, feeling drowsy and satisfied. He lay in bed for a long time, contemplating the dream. It had not really felt like a dream, and Miss Absalom had remembered him. She had called him her lover. She was not a figment in the manner of dreams. He had not ever really thought she was, only it seemed very presumptuous at the same time to imagine that she was anything but. Jonathan Strange might have gone about summoning enchantresses up at a whim, but John Segundus was far more meek. He could not think how he might merit Mariah Absalom's time, however great his zeal might be. The small, painful part of him wanted very much to have this power, to win her attention through being extraordinary. She was so very beautiful, and rather rambunctious, unabashed in her pleasure, and every time she looked at him, he felt as though the sun itself had turned and singled him out directly. Oh, he thought, what a quandary. She was real and yet unreal. He wanted her to be real, and did not believe she could be, yet he only disbelieved she could be because he thought her real. It was quite impossible. But still, he found himself so generally pleased that he was all smiles as he dressed in his bedroom. He even whistled a small phrase of music, which was not very like him. The alteration wrought by his dreams was astonishing. Upon descending the stairs, he found that the house was oddly silent. This, of course, was because Childermas had left. Childermas had left because Segundus had asked him to leave. His absence could surely be counted as a success. Yet there was no denying that without him, Staircross felt very empty. Presumably this would change when the school opened in the autumn. Then the house would be very busy indeed. But for now, he was the sole creature rattling about it. He thought somewhat dolefully that he would be quite pleased for his housekeeper to arrive the next day, or for someone from the village to seek magical assistance, for at least this would afford him some companionship. To distract himself, he took his morning cup of tea into the garden and sat cross-legged beside the rose bushes. It was a very fine Yorkshire day, a little damp but not rainy, with only a refreshing hint of rain in the air. The smell of the garden was a riot of herbs, a tangled, almost medicinal scent. Segundus spied a snake making its way over a stone. "You will refrain from eating my plants, sir," he instructed it with a frown. Then he turned his attention to the rose bushes. "Hello," he said. "I fear we have gotten off on the wrong foot. You must think me very demanding. It is only that I wish to enjoy your splendid flowers. I am also starting a school, and I believe it would benefit the students greatly to be surrounded by beauty. You could be a part of that. In a way, you could be said to teach them. It is a very noble undertaking, I think. I should be honored if you would join me in it." He waited, but there was no sign of response from the rose bushes. He sighed and thought that he had at least made the effort, and went back into the house to finish his tea. To his surprise, when he returned the next day, he found that every rose bush was now in half blossom, dense with buds that had begun to unfold. He counted several colors amongst them, a deep, dark red, a pale and lightweight creamy pink, an ivory shade, a yellow peach pink. Each was wonderfully charming in its own right, and Segundus made sure to compliment the bushes individually. Miss Absalom had been correct, or at least her advice had been sound. He wondered if he ought to consider this a mark in favor of her existence, as more than a simplified figment of dreams. He could not quite reach a conclusion. Though he was pleased about the roses, by the time the week drew to a close he had begun to feel rather bored. No one from Staircross Village had arranged to encounter a magical problem, which was not to say that Segundus wished the villagers to be beset by magical problems, and indeed he had sometimes lamented how often they seemed to be so troubled, especially on those occasions when it interrupted his research, but it was the only context in which he seemed to be able to befriend them. "I suppose I am not a socially graceful man," he said to Miss Absalom one afternoon, resting whilst in the middle of digging the hole in the garden. "I do not share a great many interests with other people, assuming they are not interested in magic. They wish to talk of farming, or the weather, or, if they are gentlemen, of politics and business and such." Miss Absalom was lounging upon a calico picnic cloth, sipping pink wine from a champagne coupe. Beside her was a silver tea tray bearing an array of iced cakes. She did not seem at all concerned that ants would get into them. "I have always suffered from much the same trouble," she said. "Well, and it is very much worse if one is a woman. It is all frocks and servants and men. I am quite happy to talk of frocks and servants of men, but to talk of nothing else, it becomes very wearying, especially when one would rather talk of magic." Segunda said, to indicate his agreement. "I suppose I assumed, when magic returned to England, that it would alter matters. But society proceeds much as it did. Even many magicians prefer to talk of business. I cannot comprehend it." "Can you not?" Miss Absalom asked, amused. "Magicians are only men and women, after all." "Chiefly men," Segunda sighed. "It is enough to make me wish I had not sent Mr. Childermas away. Extraordinarily irritating he may be, but at least he is not dull. I am most eager to see his reaction when he hears I have conquered the roses, and without a jot of his aid." This reminded him that he had not, in fact, informed Miss Absalom that he had conquered the roses. He did so now, describing their various pleasing colors. "You were quite right," he said. "They only needed their confidence built up." "Of course I was right," Miss Absalom said. "Half of being a magician is the diplomacy of wild things, and I was a very great magician in my day." "You still are, I suspect," Segunda said. He frowned. "That is to say, if we are in any particular day. Are we? I can never decide if I am dreaming when I am with you." "You are dreaming," Miss Absalom said, "but that does not mean it is not real." She sipped her wine and smiled enigmatically. "So you are real," Segunda said uncertainly. "You are not simply a fantasy of mine." At that, Miss Absalom gave a full-throated laugh. "How flattering," she said. "No, I am not your fantasy, though it is sweet of you to make such an accusation. Do I really please you so much?" "Oh, yes," Segunda said. He abandoned his digging and clambered over to where she sat. "I think you are the most pleasing person I have ever encountered." Miss Absalom looked very satisfied by this answer. She beckoned him closer and lifted the glass of wine to his lips. "Drink," she said. "This is a very fine vintage from the year that John Ashclass quarreled with winter, and the grapes ripened for 4 full summers." Segundus tasted the wine. It was like green apples and clean linen, gold wheat and crushed berries and days of sunshine. He gazed at Miss Absalom over the brim of the glass. She was watching him with a lazy expression of want. She tipped the glass forwards, and he drank again. A droplet of wine spilled past his lips. She set the glass aside and leaned forward to capture it, tracing its path with the tip of her tongue. Segundus found himself very short of breath. When she pulled away, he chased her mouth with his own, and they met in a slow, hot kiss. Segundus was surprised to find, after a few long, delicious moments, that what he chiefly wanted was to continue that kiss. It was so nice to be sitting with her there in the sunlight, tasting the faint trace of wine on her lips, with one of her hands combing through his hair. He said, rather shyly, "May I kiss you for a while?" "I would like that very much," Miss Absalom said. She drew him down beside her on the calico picnic cloth, and they kissed for a very long time like that, Segunda smoothing his hand along the white slope of her shoulder, at one point touching all the little marks of freckles that he found, for he was very fond of all her freckles, and stroked her copper-colored hair, which gleamed in the sun. "It seems most unfair," he said, "that you should be so lovely and so kind and so gifted. You are like a cup that is constantly running over." Miss Absalom screwed up her nose at this idea. "That sounds rather messy," she said with a laugh. "Though perhaps I should say, if I am a cup, then you should drink from me." And in the end, after a great deal more heated kissing, drink from her he did, pushing her skirts above her waist to sink his head between her legs, practicing meticulously the art of bringing her to climax. Scarcely had he finished than she was climbing forwards, pushing him flat onto his back, and taking him into her small, warm hand. "I want to taste you," she murmured. "Would you like that? For me to take my time, tasting you all over, taking your pleasure from you inch by inch?" Secundus gasped out something that approximated a yes. She undressed him slowly, pausing as she removed articles of clothing to kiss the most startling places. His nipples, which was astonishingly pleasurable and made him arch up towards her, and his elbows and wrists, and the soft skin over his ribs and his hip bones, and, after removing his stockings with a great deal of amusement, the bones of his ankles, which was oddly erotic. She was very thorough. He had never been kissed so thoroughly before. By the time she settled herself between his legs, he was very erect. She did not do as he had expected, though, or as he had understood the act to be practiced, but rather began by licking every part of him thoroughly. She applied the broad flat of her tongue to his prick, which made him gasp and pant, and then to the soft skin of his scrotum, which made him writhe, and then, dipping lower, licked daringly at another place entirely. This caused him to rake his hand through the grass, for he had never imagined such a thing might be so exciting. But the longer she lingered there, the more exciting it became, and by the time she penetrated him with a firm, deliberate finger while mouthing wetly at his scrotum again, he was quite ready to climax on the spot. But Miss Absalom did not permit him this. She paused in her efforts and looked up at his moan, smiling crookedly at him. "You are so hasty," she said, "rushing towards the final pages. You must learn to enjoy where you are in the book." This was such a delightfully scholarly metaphor that it made Secundus moan again. But she forced him to enjoy the point where he was a great deal more, moving her finger inside him slowly, making him feel as though his whole body were throwing sparks like a lightning storm, and licking his prick in little, gentle tongue strokes that quickly became almost torturous. "Oh," she said, "you are very beautiful like this, wild with your desire for release. Look at you." Indeed, she was gazing at him with fascination, touching herself with one hand. "I should make you satisfy me again before I let you have it. Would you like that?" Secundus had to bite his lip from uttering an obscenity. He nodded his head frantically. So with one last hard thrust of her finger and a long, wet kiss to the head of his prick, she crawled up his body and settled herself at his shoulders. She had shed her frock by this time and was fully naked, gloriously, exquisitely, mouth-wateringly naked. There was something very imperious about the way that she spread her legs and lowered herself onto his mouth so that he could press his tongue against her. He did so fervently, parting the lips of her with his fingers, working his tongue where it excited her the most. At the same time, she ground herself down against him, panting with the intensity of her pleasure, almost as though she were fucking his mouth. He kept making little helpless noises against her, noises that expressed how overwhelmed he was by arousal. He thought he might finish just from this, he was so desperate for it, and the sounds she made, and the wet heat of her quivering at his tongue tip. But he did not, and when she had stiffened and said in a drugged voice, "Oh, yes, just a little more, a little more," and climaxed shortly thereafter, she moved to take him once more with her mouth. This time she did not hold back, but applied herself with fervor, and almost immediately, feeling dazed and intoxicated, he spent. Afterwards, they lay side by side upon the picnic cloth, naked and comfortable. Secunda said, "You seem a scholar of the art of love as much as that of magic." "They are surprisingly similar," Miss Absalom said. "As I told you, a form of diplomacy. You are gifted in both, I think. One must either want happiness for other creatures or to subdue them. Sometimes both. The former is your quality. Perhaps next time I see you, we will work on spell work. If I can keep my hands off you." Secundus quite liked the idea that she could not keep her hands off him. He had never before had this effect. He wriggled closer to her and laid his head upon her shoulder. He felt a great surge of contentment. He entirely forgot that he had been lonely, or that he was, in fact, asleep in Staircross in his bed, and instead breathed in the fragrance of her warm body, enjoying the sense of being wanted.